Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in State Farm Lloyds versus Maldonado.
May it please the court, Mr. Paul Dotson will present argument from petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, the issue in this case is in many ways very straightforward. Can litigants and underlying liability claim fabricate damage findings such that they're going to bind an insurer after they've resolved their own dispute? And in the context of this case, are they going to be allowed to do it so as to enrich an admitted tortfeasor to the tune of a couple of $1 million? I submit that the answer to both these questions ought to be no, and that this court has already held that in various decisions that have led up to this particular appeal. I'll only touch briefly on the general outline of the facts in this case. After Ms. Maldonado had left the employment of Mr. Robert, he slandered her. He defamed her. He called her a prostitute. He called her a thief. He got sued. State Farm provided a defense. As the discovery progressed, Mr. Robert's credibility evaporated. The plaintiff's lawyer filed an offer of settlement, a written one which had extremely short fuse and which was in excess of the policy limits which State Farm provided. Prior, at the time that the offer of settlement expired, the deal was cut. This deal, first of all, resolved everything that was in dispute as between Ms. Maldonado and Mr. Robert, provided that he would pay $1 million, that they would go down and let the judge enter a judgment, and after that judgment, they would see how they could enrich themselves additionally at the expense of State Farm, with Mr. Robert to receive the first $1 million and splitting any money thereafter.
What's the settlement for $1.3 million?
The offer of settlement was for $1.3 million. Under the terms of the agreement which was worked out between Mr. Robert and Ms. Maldonado, he paid $1 million. At that point,
he gave her a check. Has that been cashed?
And
has that been reduced to?
Yes, that has been paid. And that is an exhibit, I think it's the defendant's exhibit. One of the plaintiff's exhibits in the record. Basically, what happened in the course of this agreement is that the same liability that Mr. Robert would have had the settlement proposal been accepted was all that he was ever liable to pay, and it's very clear that there was never an offer to settle within the policy limits, the $300,000 limits that State Farm had. At the time of the trial, if you call it that, Mr. Robert was not present, but Mr. Leon, who had been appointed to represent him and paid for by State Farm, appeared and asked no questions, offered no witnesses, made no opening statement, and the reason that he did it was quite clear, and he said it on the record. He did not want to mess up the agreement, and that was to protect his client's liability, which he feared could have been even greater than $1 million that was actually out of his pocket.
Let me ask a question. You said there was no offer within the policy limits, and the issue here is where the insured says, I'll pay some of this, and I want the insurance company to pay its policy limits. Now, why is that not an offer to settle within the limits of the policy?
Well, on its literal face, it is not. The settlement demand exceeds the policy limits. If the court has, in Garcia, recognized that should be an open question as to whether there ever could be any liability for this type of situation.
Would it be your view that unless the total offer is within the policy limits, an insurance company should have no duty to reasonably settle a case where simply its payment of the policy limits would have resolved the dispute?
Please, court, let me tell you that's not a question that this court can decide in this case. There are some questions regarding that situation, but the only holding that the court can make, I think, that you can reach, is what's going to be the role of proximate causation and if such a cause of action exists? And I think it has to be very clear that unless an insurer had that duty and was negligent in failing to make such a settlement, and that negligence caused damages to the insurer, there couldn't be any recovery. So the question is, on the proximate causation issue, what would those damages have to be? I think it's very clear that what you have to have is a cost to the insured which exceeded that lowest settlement offer that required him to pay more than the least offer that would come out of his pocket. In this case, if there is such a cause of action, there is no proximate causation because the least amount of settlement that was ever proposed would have required Mr. Robert to pay $1 million. That's all he paid. The other judgment against him was meaningless. There was, by the time that trial had been held, by the time that judgment entered, he had completely insulated himself. He had completely insulated his estate from any additional liability beyond $1 million that had been paid. There's a suggestion in plaintiff's reply to the effect that, well, Ms. Maldonado could make a claim against his estate. If the implication is that, that the estate could somehow be liable to pay such a demand, that is absolutely contradicted by the record, because both the original and the amended agreements between Mr. Robert and Ms. Maldonado provided that all the benefits of this agreement would inure to the heirs and executors of his estate. Not only was there no possibility of Mr. Robert ever incurring any additional damages, there's no possibility of his estate having any additional damages.
I'm still not clear. At the time of the settlement offer,
yes,
did State Farm understand that Roberts would pay $1 million and they were being asked to furnish the other $300,000?
The record never indicates that State Farm was made aware of Robert's willingness to do that. It's certainly not explicit in there. I was rereading Mr. Leon's testimony last night. In it, it appears that it was only the day before the settlement offer was to expire, on November the 14th, that there was discussion between Mr. Leon, Mr. Stone, who was Mr. Robert's personal counsel, and Mr. Robert. And at that point, they began to express some willingness among themselves for him to fund $1 million. I do not recall anywhere in the record where that willingness was communicated to State Farm. When this case went to trial, there were only two damage finding, only one damage finding that was made, other than attorney's fees. Nothing was submitted with respect to the contract issue. With respect to the issue on negligence, the jury only found $300,000, and that was in response to the negligence issue. And the court, trial court, and this was affirmed by the Court of Appeals, essentially held that the underlying judgment was sufficient to establish, without a jury finding, the contractual damages, and was further sufficient as a matter of law to establish the Stowers, the negligence damages. This falls squarely within the face, contrary to this court's pronouncements in the Gandy decision.
How about the argument that you failed to preserve Gandy point?
Well, if Gandy only stands for the limited proposition that certain types of assignments will not be permitted, there was no Gandy point to preserve. If that was all that Gandy stood for, it would become an interesting side note, only of historical interest, and something to be used only against lawyers who are not clever enough to have read it, and do what was done here and not have an assignment. If, on the other hand, the court meant what it said in the absence of a fully adversarial trial, the damages cannot be proven up simply by reference to the proceedings in the court below and the judgment which is entered, then the Gandy issue is completely preserved. These are the reasons why Gandy did this, are the same issues that were pointed out by this court in the Elmore decision, when the Mary Carter decision agreements were prohibited. And it's worth looking at those same concerns that this court expressed, because they're completely applicable here. The court disfavored partial settlement arrangements that promote rather than discourage further litigation. Well, why would Mr. Robert or Ms. Maldonado ever shy away from further litigation if they had hopes of collecting millions and millions of dollars? Would it skew the trial process? Well, take a look at the two prime movers in this. We've already talked some about the behavior of Mr. Robert, who first says, well, she's not a thief, and then when it's convenient after he sued, he says she is a thief, and then after it's convenient for him to say otherwise, in the current litigation, he says, she's not a thief, I never thought she was. Consider also the posture of another witness, that is Stephen Boyd, attorney from the trial. He sets up a situation where he has a time demand. It's not only made written a short time before the offers to expire. At the same time, he's sending letters claiming under his own signature that these facts show actual malice on the part of Mr. Robert. And then they do the deal. And when he comes to testify, not only is he there as a fact witness saying what a nice guy Mr. Robert is and he was just sick and confused, he's also there as an expert testimony, providing testimony regarding coverage in a case that he's got an interest in. Skew the trial process, I think that's exactly what we have here.
You admitted earlier, though, Mr. Leon testified that he could have made, that had he actively participated or found a way for his client to participate, that the judgment could have been worse. And if there is going to be a Gandy Lee's open situation where you could have a Stowers type of action when there's a demand in excess of the policy limits or some type of action, could that never be a legitimate trial strategy? Must you always go for the adversarial process, even if it's going to result in a worse eventual outcome for your client and for the carrier?
That possibility of a worse eventual outcome for the client, which is the only person that Mr. Leon could represent, was never present here when they went to trial. By the time they went to trial, they had in place an agreement that had capped his liability. It was never going to get any worse for him. Life could only get better. So in a situation where you already have this agreement in place, I don't think you never have a fully adversarial trial. Mr. Leon talked at one point, before this deal was cut, about the possibility of just contesting damages. But that's not what happened when they got to trial. He did not make an opening statement. He did not put on witnesses. He did not cross-examine. And we'd had a copy of the transcript of the testimony from the underlying trial. And basically, when you get down to it, the CPA was brought in and said, well, in my opinion, damages could be as much as $2 million. I submit you don't have to be a very good trial lawyer to be able to figure out some shot at cross-examining that sort of testimony. But the reason that Roland didn't, and it's clear from his trial testimony in this case, is not because he thought he was going to make it worse for his client. He knew he couldn't make it worse for his client. His client had been capped in his liability. He didn't want to mess up this good settlement that they had. This is not something that was protecting
I misunderstood. What is the difference between the good settlement he had and the cap to his liability?
That's exactly the... He had capped his liability.
I'm sorry. I understood you say that Mr. Leon said he didn't ask the questions because he was afraid of messing up the agreement. And he said he couldn't have messed up the agreement because Mr. Robert already had a cap.
That's right. But that's what he testified his concern was.
But I guess what I understood from the briefing was Mr. Leon said, if I'd asked the questions and did anything, then his cap might have gone away.
He expressed that concern. That was what he was concerned about.
So wouldn't it have been a legitimate trial strategy to protect the insured's position to keep the cap in force?
He protected his client's interest brilliantly. I have no complaint about the limited issue of did he take care of his client. That's not a problem here. The problem is when you try to take that protection for his client, that shield, and turn it into a sword or a club to beat State Farm over the head with. Because, let's face it, we go back, what evidence do they have of damages. No jury findings that have been followed, no jury findings with respect to the to the contract. They just aren't there. Under these situations, the court has to be more concerned with simply the matter of being a forum for resolving disputes between two litigants.
Any other questions? Thank you, sir. The court is ready to hear argument from the phone.
May it please the court, Mr. Anthony Constant will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. The briefing here and by the petitioner and its application for writ is based on fiction. That is the factual basis and statement of facts upon which all the briefing it made is entirely a fabrication. There are four fabrications I want to talk to the court about because I think they're essential to deciding the case. And the first fabrication is State Farm assumes in all its briefing without citation to any evidence that State Farm was not in charge of the defense of this case when it was tried on November 25th or some other and during the whole time. That someplace, sometime, they lost control and they weren't in charge. And the underlying fabrication opposite of that is that Mr. Robert took over and he was in charge and he was running the defense. That's all absolutely false. First of all, State Farm had the duty to take the defense. Second of all, State Farm hired Mr. Leon Thornton and Summers to defend the case. State Farm then wrote to Mr. Robert, the insured, and said, this is your lawyer. We've chosen him for you. You do exactly what he says, and we give him your full cooperation. And the
Are you saying the Tilly Doctrine is a fiction?
That the Tilly Doctrine is a fiction? No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that in this case, State Farm was always in charge of the defense, and Mr. Robert didn't take over and didn't do anything about it.
Well, but we're talking about who Mr. Leon, the hired attorney, owed his duty to.
Yes, sir.
He may have been making decisions, but it's whose interest he was looking for.
All right, Your Honor.
And I personally find it somewhat resentful. I resent you coming in and saying the word fabrication. I'm waiting for you to say a lie in the record, and then it appears what we're doing is just having an argument about the appropriate legal standard or about who's calling the shots between an attorney and his client, which doesn't seem to me to rise to the level of a rather strong word.
Your Honor, I apologize to the court if I have acted badly by saying it was a fabrication, but...
Well, some misunderstanding or...
All right, Your Honor.
If they're not going to be stronger than that.
It was a misunderstanding, Your Honor. That is, there is no testimony in this case that Mr. Robert at any time gave the lawyer any instructions whatsoever, or that he took any action whatsoever that interfered with State Farm's control of the defense. And the reason I think that is important because State Farm's briefing here is that the entire briefing is based on the idea that Mr. Robert did something wrong and that in the trial of the case, there wasn't an actual trial, but in fact, there was some sort of agreement that's not stated anywhere, that there's no evidence directly of, but that there's just some sort of agreement here and that was done. But
is an insurance company bound by the attorney it hires to represent one of its insurers by any of the conduct that attorney undertakes?
They should certainly be at least not allowed to attack the conduct if the conduct we're talking about is the quality of the defense of the lawsuit. Now, the quality of the defense of the lawsuit, which is what they're saying, is he should have examined and he should have cross-examined and offered testimony. If there's something wrong with the way it was done, if the quality is poor, if the quality is bad, and State Farm is saying, because he didn't do it, therefore we're off the hook, and we have no contractual obligation at all, saying, there they are bound not to come in and complain. The defense which we provided, the lawyer which we hired, did such a bad job that there really wasn't an adversarial trial, there wasn't any examination of the witness.
Well, in that issue, though, in the context of the policy, whether there was an actual trial or not, as opposed to whether Leon's representation was negligent or not. Would you agree those are two different things?
Yes, Your Honor, I do agree that those are two different things.
And he can be absolutely non-negligent and do exactly what he did, but the question is whether it was an actual trial or the policy is not providing coverage.
What I'm suggesting to the court, Your Honor, is that if, in fact, although I cited several cases to indicate what happened was an actual trial because there wasn't any agreement about the outcome, either liability or damages. But what I'm suggesting to the court is that if this isn't an actual trial, then the responsibility for that is with State Farm, the insured, the insurance company, and not with its insured.
Because of the control argument you made.
Yes, Your Honor, because they are controlled, because it's their duty to control and run it, because they did, in fact, run it, because all the discussions about strategy were with State Farm. None of it was with Robert, and Robert never made any instruction whatsoever
about how to get it. Who is the attorney's client? The insurance company or the insured?
The attorney's client, it appears to me, is both in this situation. That is, for the trial of the case, he certainly owes full loyalty to Mr. Leon. But
what happens if the insurance company and the insured's interests become adverse during the course of the representation? To whom does the attorney owe the duty?
To the insured. And if, in fact, Your Honor, the State Farm came to the conclusion, as they said in their letter on November 22nd, that, in fact, some deal has been cooked up and there's going to be an agreed judgment, State Farm there has the opportunity, if they desire to do so, to replace that counsel. If they think there's not going to be a real fair trial, they're not really going to get to prove it up, it seems to me they have the right to replace counsel right then and substitute other counsel who will see to it that there is an actual trial. And that instead what they did was they said that's what they believe, they sat back and watched this trial occur, and then afterwards made no complaint about it, didn't file a motion for new trial, didn't appeal it, didn't make any effort to stop that from occurring. They were in control, and then they say, well, as a result of that, we don't have any contractual liability because it wasn't an actual trial.
Going back to my question, is there anything in the record that State Farm knew they were being asked for policy limits as part of the settlement offer? In other words, that Roberts would pay $1 million and State Farm was being asked to settle for
the testimony is undisputed that on October the 2nd, the offer was made to settle for $1.3 million. One witness said it was $300,000 from State Farm and $1 million from the insured. Now, when the offer was actually made, I mean, when the insured was actually told on the 14th, one, you're in serious trouble, this case has more value than $50,000 we told you before, and in fact, it's so bad, you should pay $1 million. First time he was told that was on November 14th, the day before the deadline. And he was told that by Mr. Leon. There isn't any testimony after that directly that Mr. Leon said specifically to the insurance company, he has agreed to do that. And no one asked about it because I think it was not issued in the case. It was understood that they were aware of it. That's why they were going through the process on the 15th of making a decision whether or not to pay the $300,000. That's why the claim committee on the 15th made the decision $300,000 should be paid. There wouldn't be any reason to do that but for the fact that they understood that the situation was if they paid it, the case would be settled. And there is testimony that Mr. Leon's in conversation with him on the 5th and about what's going to be done in the case. So that's all there is. Nobody actually stood up and said, we didn't know about it, and nobody said we told them about it. We sort of assumed that.
State Farm tried to intervene?
Yes, Your Honor, they did. State Farm came on the 25th and asked to intervene as a party and wanted to be a party in the case. And I think what that demonstrates is that they, at least what they said on the record then was, we think there's going to be an agreed judgment, which wasn't true. That's not what was going on. But with that belief, Your Honor, what they could have done and should have done is they thought that something bad was going to happen that wasn't proper under the contract. That is, a good defense wasn't going to be put on. They surely could have fired that lawyer and got another one. They could have objected to this new judge, or they could have asked for a continuance. There was no interest, Your Honor, with regard to Mr. Robert in having a big judgment against him. It is not a good thing to have a large judgment against him. Although State Farm suggests that this was something that he was really looking forward to, and he would be happy to have
it. The deal was structured, the bigger the judgment against him,
the better for him.
Your Honor, the way the deal was structured was, he paid $1 million, and what he got in exchange was a covenant that they would not execute.
They recorded
It's not in the record that they did so, Your Honor, but...
What did they agree not to report to AFSCME?
No, Your Honor. If you look at the agreement in May of 91, which is the final agreement in the matter, no one we've got in the record is complete. They did. There is nothing that prevents them from abstracting the judgment. There is nothing which prevents them from filing a claim with his estate after his death, and that's important because in this case, it was known that the insured was dying and was expected to be dead by September of 92. This wasn't just something in the future. He had a fatal disease. And there also, Your Honor, was nothing that could prevent them from filing a claim should he go to the bankruptcy court if he had to do that. There's nothing to prevent them there. But the most important was there was nothing to prevent the abstract.
Is so, a Flanger defamation claim dischargeable in bankruptcy?
Your Honor, I don't know that. I don't have the answer to that one, whether it is or isn't.
Getting back to the Chief Justice's question,
yes,
it was to his interest that the court assess damages as high as possible because he was going to possibly recoup $1 million and share in anything extra after he recouped $1 million.
Well, let me talk about
is that correct or not?
Yes.
All right.
But it's correct because if there was negligence on the part of State Farm, if he had no agreement, Your Honor, with him, that is, that he's going to have to pay part of whatever he recovered to the plaintiff, then he would have gotten it all. So agreeing to give something to some other party, the plaintiff didn't encourage him to sue, Your Honor. And, Your Honor.
But as far as proving up his damages and the state of the law at the time of this trial, he was a lot better off with a large judgment than a small judgment, no?
Well, Your Honor, only if one is better off being in debt in a position where you can sue somebody to recover it, that's a good thing. I think, Your Honor, most people would agree that that's not a good thing. It would have been much better for him if what had happened is the case would either settle for $1.3 million, or that after he made the agreement, they went down and tried the case, and he was found not liable because he didn't slander her, or that the judgment was found under $300,000.
He got $1 million under either one of those scenarios with no possibility of recruitment by him or his estate.
He is out $1 million, but that isn't any. He doesn't have any complaint about that because he voluntarily paid the money. He doesn't have anybody to sue over that. He is out the money, but he's out the money because of the situation, not because of State Farm's conduct. He doesn't have any lawsuit. He would have at least had the matter over with. So making the agreement didn't encourage him to sue. What encouraged him to sue was their negligence.
I'm interested in whether or not it seems to me the only issue in this case is the Stowers' obligation to the insurance company. And the question is, was this a settlement within the policy limits? And clearly the only demand is 1.3. The idea that 1 million come from the insured and 300,000 from the insurer. It appears to me from all that's been argued so far this morning is that the 1.3 was not an unconditional settlement demand. It really appears to be 1.3 with the assignment of whatever comes at the end of this lawsuit, claims to be made, and apparently the cooperation of Mr. Robert to not interfere in some way with the lawsuit to prove up damages against State Farm. And Mr. Leon apparently felt that if he participated in any way, he might mess up the deal. It sounds an awful lot like even if we accepted that an insurance company could be soured by the insured offering to pay whatever is demanded in excess of policy limits, this had so many conditions or unwritten conditions or implied conditions that there's just no way you could say this was an unconditional offer settled within the policy limits.
Your Honor, I believe the statement of facts will not bear that out, that there's not anything that indicates that anything conditional about the offer, Your Honor.
But didn't Mr. Leon say that he couldn't participate in the trial for fear that he would mess up the agreement? I mean,
what he said, Your Honor, was that he, at the trial of this case, he said, I didn't want to put on any evidence was because I did not want to jeopardize what I already accomplished for the trial. Now, that's all the testimony there is. He doesn't explain what he means by that or how cross-examining a witness
could have jeopardized anything because Mr. Robert had already paid $1 million for the contract. So whatever agreement provided, he had all the benefits of it right then and there. And there was no provision in any agreement that he wouldn't cross-examine the court saying that there were all these conditions, and one of them being that Mr. Robert wouldn't interfere with the trial case. That's not correct, Your Honor. There is no evidence that either Mr. Robert or Mr. Leon on his behalf or anybody else ever agreed about how they would defend the case, whether they would or wouldn't call witnesses, whether they would or wouldn't cross-examine, or anything whatsoever with regard to the trial case. The offer was unconditional. It was made on October 2nd, Your Honor. And at that time, the offer was settled for $1.3 million. Just before the 28th, Lawyer Leon testifies he got an extension of some deadline on it. And he got an extension of time on that. And that extension of time was placed in writing on a letter dated November the 11th that said $1.3 million. And from that, from October 2nd to November 15th at 5 o'clock, when that deadline was erased, the offer was always 1.3 without any condition whatsoever about any sort of assignment, so there's not a word of that. The agreement with regard to the sharing of the proceeds, and that's what we're talking about, between Maldonado and Robert, all occurred on the 15th after it became clear State Farm was not going to respond before the deadline, that they weren't going to make any offer regarding the matter at all. And then after 5 o'clock, they proceeded to go to the details of the agreement and wrote up an agreement either that evening or soon thereafter, but made the agreement. So there was nothing conditional about it at all.
The agreement not to execute on Robert's personal assets, that didn't include the $1 million. The million dollar check was cashed?
Yes, Your Honor, it was cashed. It was paid prior to the trial on November 25th. Absolutely, Your Honor. It's in evidence as PX something. Your Honor, the other assumptions, I guess, that I want to talk about, we have discussed really, which is that the agreement itself meant that the insured suffered no damages, and that's not correct for the reason I stated, which was there was nothing to prevent you from abstracting the judgment, and there was nothing to prevent them from filing a claim against the estate. Your Honor, the agreement which was made also did not violate the contract whatsoever. The only provision State Farm reports in the contract
In your remaining time, can you speak to us as to why you think Gandy does not apply?
I think Gandy does not apply because there wasn't any fraud whatsoever by the insured or any conduct by the insured at all that was bad with regard to the defense of this case, Your Honor. And the insured was never in control of it. State Farm was always in control of it. So whatever the quality of the defense of the case, that's a matter laid at the door of the State Farm. They ought not to be allowed to come in and say...
I know you argue that, but under Tilly, you know, the attorney's loyalty was to the insured.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you can't have it both ways. You know, you seem to imply that, if I understand your argument, you're saying, well, even though under Tilly and the jurisprudence of Texas, the attorney hired by the insurance company's loyalty is due to the insured, State Farm had control. State Farm could have fired it, and therefore, because they could have fired the attorney whose loyalty was to be insured, therefore State Farm could not complain. Is that basically your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. They were responsible for the defense. Under Tilly, Your Honor, I don't... The failure in this case to cross-examine witnesses or put on witnesses does not... There is no indication except this one statement by counsel about why he didn't want to jeopardize what he accomplished.
Well, how about the attempted intervention? Attempted intervention by State Farm to protect their own interests.
Well, but that, I understand it, under all law, that's not the way it is done. For instance, you can't just march into somebody else's lawsuit and intervene and have State Farm party in the case. But what they had the right to do was control the defense. What they did, if they thought it wasn't being defended right, they could have got in there and defended it. It doesn't appear to me, Your Honor, that in following Tilly and in honoring their duty to the client, that there's anything helpful here about whether some conflict, anything helpful about not cross-examining witnesses or not putting on witnesses.
Well, and in the agreement, though, between Montanaro and Robert, there was an upside to Robert with a large verdict in the case.
Your Honor, it wasn't.
Correct? I mean, there was an upside in the contract
between those two parties?
Your Honor, I don't think that is correct, because the upside you're talking about is created by the opportunity, if that's what it is, for the insured to sue his insurance company for negligence. Mr. Robert was given that opportunity not by the agreement, but by the negligence of State Farm. The agreement discouraged him because the agreement required him to give away part of what he might actually be able to recover against his insurance company.
But if his insurance company would then have to pay the $1 million eventually, plus he was going to split whatever there was above $1 million upside to Mr. Robert under that agreement.
Your Honor, the insurance company wasn't going to have to pay the $1 million which he paid, and the agreement didn't make them liable for the $1 million he paid. They would be liable only for what they owed on the contract and for negligence. And so the agreement that they made didn't produce a situation that wasn't there before. That is, produce a situation where now he can recover damages if the judgment gets real big, whereas before he couldn't. He was always in a situation where if the damages got very large and he had a negligence claim, that he could pursue it. The agreement didn't make the damages greater, and it didn't improve his situation with regard to his upside in terms of getting it. In fact, it decreased it, Your Honor, in the sense that after $1 million, half of that had to go somebody else. So it wasn't something that encouraged him to sue, Your Honor. If they had defended the case and gotten a $300,000 judgment, the matter would have been over with, or anything under $1.3 million would have been over with. He had no damages, assuming they paid the contract.
Any other questions? Thank you. In Gandy and in every other case like this I've seen, the insured is sort of left high and dry, and they're trying to cut the best deal they can on their own because the insurance company's gone. Here, State Farm provided an attorney who either thought this up or participated in it or condoned a process that, at least as I understand the law, was legal at the time, and under Republic, the more damages you got, the better your liquidated damages at the next trial, and has since Texas has joined the majority of American jurisdictions in condemning it. But why shouldn't an insurance company be stopped by the conduct of its insured that's done with the participation of the attorney provided by the insurance company?
Well, as this court pointed out in footnote 6 of the RCA decision, as it says in the Bible, you can't serve two masters, and would put not only the insurance defense counsel, but the entire system, adversarial system upon which we rely for not just resolving disputes, but for producing justice at risk, were we to allow the argument which is being made by Mr. Constant. There's no question that Mr. Leon understood exactly where he stood in this. As he said, I had a long-term client, State Farm, that what we were doing was not in their best interest. There are times conceivably where they're walking along the same path, insured and insurer, and the attorney doesn't have to make any decisions.
Why couldn't the insurance company have fired him and brought in another attorney?
That would be a fun lawsuit for the plaintiffs. They go in and perhaps set aside this agreement after he has managed to cap his liability at the least possible settlement proposal, and thereby exposing to additional money exposure beyond that, which he would have had otherwise. He might have a real good lawsuit there. Putting them in a posture of saying, well, this deal might be good for you, but it's not good for us, therefore we're not going to permit it.
But that would have been a lawsuit by the insured against the insurance company for that conduct.
That would have been that.
So then, is this a situation where the insurance company is trying to decide which of two bad consequences it wants to choose in this case? They could either fire the attorney, bring in another one, have a better result for the insurance company, but maybe get sued down the road, or they could go ahead and just stick with the attorney, what he's doing, and maybe win it on appeal here.
Clearly the first option, where an
insurance company is in litigation involving its insurer, taking a position and working actively against it, that would be infamous. Does that leave people without a remedy? Well, I guess there's two issues that we have here. One, at some point we've got a contract issue, although there are no findings of damages under the contract issue. Let's assume that when Mr. Leon was at Lair when these agreements were being made, after 5 o'clock when the settlement proposal expired, at that point that somehow he could give permission, or that somehow what he did not leave Mr. Robert in violation of contractual provision, that no insurance will assume an obligation to incur an expense without our consent. Let's assume that he gave that consent. In this case, there would still be contractual issues as to why they should not recover.
If there's a demand in excess of the settlement, that the insured can never pay off any part of that without the insurance company's permission, even if the insurance company is willing to tender its maximum policy limits in as part of the bargain?
I hesitate to say never. In the context of this case, it certainly ought not.
But if the answer is not never, I mean, if you could sometimes do that, then can an insurance company have an attorney who, in the odd situation here, there's the settlement with a cap, and then they go to trial, and if that trial had been adversarial, it might still have complied with the policy. But by the attorney sitting back and doing nothing, it renders it non-adversarial, which then under Gandy might excuse the insurance company from any obligation. Can the insurance company provide that kind of representation to a client and escape any liability?
It's not uncommon, in fact, for insurance companies and appointing counsel to allow the insurers to choose their own counsel over proceedings.
Well, that's not done here. He had to take who they gave him. They gave him somebody. But somebody didn't provide a defense at this post-settlement trial. If that's the grounds, the fact that that was not adversarial, that you escape liability on, did the insurer have to live with that?
Well,
isn't that yet a further breach of a duty?
In the context of this case, where the adversity had already been established, it's very clear that because of the agreement that had been reached, that Mr. Leon could not possibly be given consent on behalf of the insurance company. That is something generally beyond the limited authority that an attorney has. If they have the express authority to do it, that's fine. He didn't have it here.
So the vice comes in the client being willing to pay $1 million without the insurance company's express agreement to do so.
That certainly violates the contractual provision, as well as the problem that, in separate distinct that Mr. Robert said he never thought Ms. Maldonado was a prostitute with him, and never had. That's a real problem for him. That's a clear and unequivocal statement.
These problems, if we follow the Stowers line of cases, that the duty on the insurance company never arises if there's not a demand within the policy limits. We stick with that holding, and there was never a demand in this case within the policy limits to settle the case, then all these other issues we've discussed go away.
Absolutely. And given the statements on this case, just the basic fraud as was described in the game, opinion, particularly by the Court of Appeals. This is the sort of issue which is obviously broader than the dispute between these parties. There are public policy, there are public value questions here. And what plaintiffs are asking you to sets very bad values for us to follow.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second cause. The court will take another brief recess.
All rise.